Hello out there in Webland, and welcome to the LBC podcast. I'm Edward Champion.
And I'm, Carolyn Kellogg. Wait a minute.
Yes, Carolyn?
Are you sure you've got our names right?
Absolutely. Ed?
Well, anyway, our names don't matter. What's important here are the books. We're gathered here today in the San Francisco studio for...
No, we're not.
What?
I'm not in San Francisco. I'm in Pittsburgh. You're in San Francisco.
No. I am tossing you a basketball. I am shaking your hand. It was such an honor to have you fly out here all the way from Pittsburgh on the LBC's dime.
No, I didn't.
Carolyn, you're spoiling the illusion. Our listeners don't know.
And if they're smart enough to read, they're smart enough to figure out our obvious ruse.
Well, of course. Whether Carolyn is here or in Pittsburgh does not matter in the slightest. What does matter
is a meaningful discussion of books
by the Lit Blog Co-op. And we're actually here from the Sherwood Anderson Memorial Fairgrounds.
Read my lips. No new mixes. Didn't we already talk about this?
The parking lot of the fairgrounds. In fact, to introduce our first book, Sideshow.
Ed Calliope music is not fairground music.
It's not?
Never mind. To introduce the book, we've got Jeff Bryant from the Lit Blog Co-op. She put
$900 on the floor. So I'm here with the one, the only, Jeff Bryant, the blogger behind Syntax of Things, who has nominated Sideshow by Cindy Thompson for the LBC. Jeff, how are you doing?
Doing pretty good, Ed. Thank you.
Well, first off, what was it about Cindy Thompson's book that kind of got you sort of, you know, saying, hey, this is the one for the LBC?
Right, yeah, it was kind of a roundabout way, actually. I read a review of it in Pace Magazine, and in the review, the one thing that stuck out to me, and I guess, you know, was my love of the band itself, but the reviewer said that this was the South scene more through a R.E. prism than William Faulkner's prism. So then I was like, oh, well, you know, that's enough for me to give it a chance, and went looking up about, I'd never heard of Sidney Thompson or the book, so I, you know, looking around, found the publisher, which happened to be in Montgomery, Alabama, which is not far from where I grew up, and I thought to myself, well, I didn't know there was a publisher in Montgomery, Alabama, so I wrote to them. They said they would send me a copy of it, and from there, I noticed some of the blurbs on the back, which, you know, I take it for what it's worth, but the blurbs were, Barry Hanna wrote a blurb, one of my favorite writers, George Singleton, wrote a blurb, another friend of mine, Tom Franklin, wrote a blurb. So I was like, well, okay, this is going to go right to the top of my list. And I read the stories, and really, it really did ring a bell that it was, you know, definitely the Southern writing is there, but it was a different twist on it than what I guess you normally would think of with Southern writing, if you could put it into some sort of category.
Certainly. Yeah, actually, it's funny, because I just talked with Cindy Thompson, and we'll be hearing that conversation very soon, and cited the exact same Paste review, as a matter of fact, same phrase. Well, what do you think it is? Why do you think Southern writing has this particular impression, and what makes Thompson sort of, you know, go beyond it?
Well, it's a good question, and one I've kind of been bouncing around in my head a little bit in preparation to write an introduction for this, for the LBC. Southern writing for me has always sort of had that kind of Faulkner-esque, you know, kind of dark gothic mood to it. And for better or for worse, you have the notion of race relationships enter in, and the poor versus the rich, and you know, you could go on and on about what is Southern writing, what isn't Southern writing, you know, and is there a new Southern writing coming around? But then you look at writers like Larry Brown and Southern writers like Larry Brown and Tom Franklin, and you know, the list is expansive. But you know, there's still holding on to a lot of that. There's still a lot of that there. And in fact, with Thompson, I was reminded a lot of Larry Brown. And it could be that I was reading it at the same time I've been rereading Larry Brown's stuff, but Thompson is more, it is as if Larry Brown was listening to R.E.M. and writing his stories instead of listening to, you know, Merle Haggard. I don't know. That's just what struck me about it.
The characters in the stories are rather unusual in the sense that they have really sort of crazed sort of problems. Was this a factor that kind of made the books stick out for you? Or?
Yeah, I mean, and the fact that I think that one of the things that I really enjoy is kind of a strange word to use, but the book made me uncomfortable. You know, the stories made me uncomfortable, several of them, you know, and just I had to kind of question, well, is that just, you know, the prism through which I'm reading it through, or is it, you know, something else going on there? But you can't read a story about an incestual relationship between a mother and a son and who is going out to basically run away with a 14-year-old girl, and then there's whole race relationship thing going on. I mean, it just, there's so much going on in those little stories that drew me into them.
Certainly. Well, I mean, do you think that this is the kind of answer for Southern fiction to sort of break out of its mantle to essentially deal with these really uncomfortable avenues such as incest and such as like the husband's story?
I think there's plenty of that going on in Southern fiction, and sure, I'm looking forward to reading what people like Thompson and, you know, writers like Thompson are doing. And, you know, Jack Pendarvis does a lot of the same things with his stories. So not to say that I don't really enjoy a good old, you know, traditional Southern tale, but I do think this is a nice new path for Southern writing.
Gotcha. All right, well, Jeff, thank you so much.
Sure.
All right. So I am here with Sidney Thompson, who is the author of Sideshow, which is a LBC nominee for this quarter. Sidney, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Anyway, I wanted to actually touch upon something that was mentioned in Paste Magazine. There was a review that suggested that this collection represents the South seen more through the prism of R.E.M. than William Faulkner. Now, I wanted to get your thoughts on this. Do you consciously try to write against Southern fiction expectations, or?
Well, I try to write against all expectations. I mean, that's one goal I have. Southern, sure. I don't want to just have magnolias and mint juleps and barefoot, freckled women on porch steps, but I do try to work against the grain and sometimes play with stereotypes, and I'll work them in as well, sure.
Okay.
I do have a great love, admiration for European literature, the existentialist, and I try to blend some of that with the Southern setting. And so there's absurdity, sure, and try to fight those expectations. But I was very happy by the musical reference of R.E.M. And maybe that comes in part from being from Memphis, a music town. Music definitely influences me, inspires me, and I often listen to music when I'm writing because I want it to feed my soul and help me subliminally with rhythm of language. So, it's not something I do consciously, but fully, but certainly it's in the back of my mind, I guess.
Well, what kind of, how does music help you when you write? Because your tales deal with a lot of freaks, supposedly, and misfits, or, I don't know, I mean, the term freak to me implies someone who is, I guess, deviant or something, but you know, your characters have really sort of genuine problems, and we'll touch into that in just a bit, but what role does music play in terms of... you know, attracting this particular prism, so to speak, and maybe we can kind of go from there in terms of, like, you know, what what steps you take as a writer to observe this type of behavior and incorporate it into your stories.
Well, I'm very much influenced by music, and I would say I'm as influenced by music as other writers. And like I say, I think a writer can benefit from learning from music, with theme and sub-theme, how musically you should have surprise and layering effects. And I think I turn to music more for the technical aspect of writing as opposed to the subject matter. Mm-hmm. So even though I'm writing about misfits, I don't turn to music or need to be fed from it in terms of that subject matter of how we might be a little eccentric, but I just love music, and I want the language to be rhythmic and flowing and surprising, the way great art should be. And I don't think the subject matter really is relevant to my love of music.
What I mean to suggest is that music then serves as a kind of structural kind of place for you,
Absolutely. And now that we're talking about it, maybe it does connect with that misfit quality about myself. I'm trying to be really honest with you here, and I'm a failed musician. I took piano lessons. I was in band for many years. I played trumpet, and I so love music that I wanted to be a musician, and when I realized that that was not going to work for me, loving the arts, I just turned to a different medium. But I can't get away from it. It's such a powerful force, and one should be inspired by. And I don't think writers should be afraid to admit how important music is, and it should come into the work. I bring it in time and time again as much as I can, because it is so important to me.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about some of the themes in these stories. For example, I noticed that there was, many of these stories kind of dealt with the redemptive power and in some case the trappings of how father-son relationships kind of aid or sort of bring down or encourage or remedy a dysfunctional family. Now, I'm wondering what it is about this theme that attracts you and why the sort of, why this interesting sort of patriarchal fixation?
I guess there's an autobiographical slant to that. I guess the easy answer is, hey, I grew up in a dysfunctional family, parents divorced, and there are always, like in the story of the voyeur, the son is obsessed with learning who his parents really are, and not until they are separated, living in their own residence, does he really come to learn who each one is. And I certainly identify with that. I've had a really strong relationship with my mother and my father, and you can see that with a relationship with the characters, with their parents, and certainly don't want to say anything libelous about.
No.
But I guess I work certain things out in my fiction, and certainly the fiction isn't meant to be purely autobiographical, but certainly there are things that I can't forget, and I work things out and blend with imagination and come up with something entirely different from my own experiences at times. But certainly there are thematically the importance of family, the struggle of family, the difficulty of family, those are certain elements that I can't escape because they do represent my life.
Sure. Well, is family sort of a good kind of starting point for you when you're kind of, I mean, we see a lot of families in Southern fiction, and would you say that this serves as a kind of starting point for you to structure a story, or
a starting point? I suppose, but because I've been at times so close and so distant with my family. I have one brother and then my parents, and I grew up in Memphis, and I had a lot of relatives who lived out in the country, and I was so excited as a city boy leaving just my brother and mother and father, and getting to stay the summers with grandparents and cousins, aunts and uncles, and having this big extended family out in the country where men were men and women were women, and kind of in more traditional roles. And it was exciting to experience that. And I suppose it was so exciting that I have, early on in my writing career with my short stories, I felt a need to have characters dealing with that, the relationships they have with their family members.
Well, at the same time, these stories also deal with very interesting taboos within these family structures. Like, we were talking about the voyeur and how this kind of concerns a sort of maternal lust. And you also have a very interesting revelation over the course of a drunken night in The Husbands. Is taboos sort of something that is of interest to you, particularly family taboos?
Well, I suppose my truly first teacher was Barry Hannah. Mm-hmm. At the University of Mississippi, and he really encouraged us to write stories that people haven't read before, and I suppose that could encourage a young writer to investigate taboos, and so I certainly deal with those, but I didn't want to just be sensational, I wanted to be subtle and investigate those in a way that the characters would be humanized, and so that there would be a genuine investigation, with much seriousness. Mm-hmm. Even though there's surely plenty of humor and irony in the stories, I didn't mean for there to be as much drama, just straight serious drama with characters struggling with very deviant aspects about themselves that they're not proud of.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting to me, I mean, this notion of, like, shock value, and also, you know, making sure that you kind of hook the audience. What do you feel is kind of the happy medium between sort of playing it safe and shock value, or the sensationalism? I mean, at what point can you risk losing the audience, and at what point do you have to, like, grab them by the lapels by something as, you know, really fascinating as the voyeur? Is this a concern of you, for you when you write, or?
Well, it's a concern for the fact that I certainly don't want to write myself ever into a corner, and that's the big risk when you're dealing with big sensational issues, taboos, and just as quickly you need to turn and show that there's a reason, and that it's that, you know, there's great purpose there, and I'm conscious of that always, and I do like to play with stereotypes, play with assumptions. I think people generally tend to judge others far too much, and I like to remind readers of that. It seems too often people can only accept the truth and nonfiction instead of fiction. Like, it's easier to take a pedophile when you're watching To Catch a Predator on television than it is to follow a character who is a pedophile in a story written by someone who is honestly trying to create that point of view in an honest way. Mm-hmm. And I do want to remind people that it is necessary to investigate these subjects in fiction, because you really can't get the point of view of that character that we don't want to be like, unless it is in fiction.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting to me because, like, for example, a story like The Romanticist and The Classicist has this, not exactly irony of, like, this, you know, this duo quoting all these, you know, classical references and the like while they're doing pretty despicable deeds. And this interested me because the way you approached it was not necessarily so much ironic as it was sort of revealing of character. And I'm wondering what steps you take to kind of hone these stories to sort of make sure that it's not sort of an irony for irony's sake, and that it's more of a sort of these characters are sort of, you know, these are their lives. They're intricately complex. There are plenty of gray areas. I mean, is this must be a struggle for you as a writer when you're, you know, honing these stories down.
You know, I don't know if there's a trick. There's nothing I'm intentionally doing. I just really love my characters, even when at times they're despicable. And I just want them to breathe on the page. And, you know, I'm certainly striving for realism all the way, even in the most fantastic situations. I absolutely want the reader to believe that these events can happen, have probably happened somewhere before, and that's truly my only goal. And It is part of my worldview to have an ironic slant, having a father who's highly educated, who knows the difference between right and wrong, and wants to take his son with him next door as part of his classical education to witness the murder of a neighbor. And I do believe that could truly happen. And there is irony intended for that, to remind those who are educated that education, literature, or those things are not the only answers in terms of making us good people. Sometimes I think we pat ourselves too much on the back for being readers. Mm-hmm. They can instruct us, but they can also encourage actions, behaviors that are unacceptable.
Well, also with that story, you're dealing with the interesting conflict of the reading world versus the real world. You know, and that's as much of a, you know, I mean, it's basically when one subscribes to either completely, it's almost as if it's like, you know, something of a trap, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And we've all done it, haven't we? I mean,
oh yeah.
As readers, we escape, and you know, into books, and sometimes in preference of some real event or some moment we could have shared with somebody. And And there is absurdity in that at times, and in part that's what I'm trying to explore in that story, the romanticist and the classicist.
Sure. Well, there's also often an inability of your characters to sort of connect with the world around them. I think specifically of Larry Harvard in The Floater, or Arnold in The Chameleon, which was the story I was blanking out on earlier. This is also a recurring theme, and I'm wondering what draws you to this kind of these sort of misfit loners who are sort of really almost doing anything they can to connect, and certainly both Larry and Arnold both, you know, really try to throw themselves off the deep end in an effort to kind of reach out to this world that they can't quite fit in to, you know?
I guess it's egotism. often I feel that way. Most writers, artists, feel that way. Maybe most people in general feel that way. Difficulty in fitting in. What lengths will you go to fit in? And you know, I have characters who time and time again fall into that desperate need to connect with someone. So I have a character who goes to a bus depot simply to meet people, make temporary friends, and it seems safe because he knows he probably won't get too close with them because eventually they're going to have to leave. So there's no real threat for him to really lose much. Mm-hmm. And of course that leads to turning that upside down and having him meet somebody who wants to get closer. So that is my starting point for a lot of my stories. Just a loner, desperate for attention, desperate for some human connection, and what that need leads into is the plot and the conflict of the story.
Sure. I'm wondering how much of your stories are you know, basically what I'm getting at here and what I'm hearing from you is that many of them are actually drawn from your own sort of personal experience, and that realism is of great importance in sort of, you know, fashioning plots and the like. And I'm curious, is there any sort of level of invention going on, or what's the level of invention like in relation to drawing upon personal experience or a narrative that you possibly observed in the real world that you want to transpose into short story form?
Well, there's plenty of invention, and usually when talking to other writers or readers of my work, that they're often surprised that there is anything that's autobiographical in the stories, because they seem so outlandish, the characters or the situations. But I do love research, and I have no experience as an airbrush artist, but I thought it would be fun, it would be right for this particular character in The Counterfeiter to be an airbrush artist. Mm-hmm. Where did he obtain his skills to counterfeit? So, you know, I needed to invent an airbrush artist, do some homework with that. And in other stories, I certainly turned to research to create a character outside of myself, but as much as I do that, as much as I invent characters that seem bizarre and one of a kind, that I still connect with them, all of them, emotionally, with that hunger for genuine connection, friendship, love. Not that I think that I've been lacking in some abnormal way, or that I was reared in a way that was, you know, truly atypical, but maybe I just responded to that in a more needful or striking way than others, and so I deal with that in those stories time and time again, that feeling of loss and lack of connection, and I turn to invention to create characters that are unlike me, since I've, for the most part, found myself in my life a little boring, a little bland, and so I want to create more interesting characters than myself.
So you
still are like me.
Yeah, yeah. So for you, it seems to me that, you know, you need to really seriously emotionally connect with a character before you can write a story?
That's true.
Yeah.
Even somebody like Ernest, who seems like a devil of a character, but the way I look at him is just he's a mischievous guy who doesn't mean as much harm as he certainly creates. But, you know, I certainly like all of my characters, the most despicable ones, I need to connect with them and divest myself of emotional attachment to them. And if they are somewhat despicable, I guess I'm trying to psychoanalyze myself now.
What?
Maybe I use humor to humanize them. Mm. So if by laughing at them, I like them better because they make me laugh. Maybe that's why I'm using humor in certain situations or with certain characters that otherwise, you know, I probably wouldn't want to work with.
I'm trying to sort of get a sense of what we're talking about here. You're saying, you know, divest yourself of emotional connection and also emotional connection. What is generally, like, say, the process? Maybe you can sort of describe this with one of your particular stories, perhaps with, you know, Ernest or another character. I mean, in terms of, like, I mean, this has got to be a tricky sort of situation, because if you empathize too much with a character, then, you know, you may sort of prevent him. I don't know. I mean, maybe you can go ahead and describe this.
Well, like with Ernest,
yeah.
You know, I intellectually, I wanted to explore the idea of how does someone become amoral, and so I invented a situation where, well, let's just say he had a mentally handicapped mother who raised him, and so he hasn't been exposed to instruction the way most of us have in terms of what's moral and immoral. And how would one live his life, making choices. Well, in terms of the will, how does somebody who is amoral get through life? And I suppose it's in me to be empathetic to someone like Ernest, who could abandon this girl who's entrusted her life with him. How could we empathize with this guy who seems at times just an animal, a creature,
yeah,
who's violent and certainly tends to be inclined more toward immoral than moral. I just felt that there's just a need to embrace somebody like this and just see for a moment how somebody gets in this position so that we can guard against it ourselves. And that seems important for anybody, not just for some voyeuristic need to watch somebody behave wrongly, but I mean for it to be instructional. How do we go from being a moral person to an amoral person? Certainly, we can all do that at times, so it seems necessary to follow somebody like an Ernest, whether for laughs or for instruction about the will, about choices, about morality. So that's my need as a writer, to follow somebody like that.
So you kind of need a sort of ethical conundrum to kind of kickstart a story?
I do like moral dilemmas. I do want stories to be exciting and big. I do think it's necessary for a writer. The writer owes the reader something.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's big and troublesome, about the big issues of, you know, life and death, family, God. And we shouldn't shy away from that. Sometimes there's too much attention. This is my bias. Too much attention to style. I mean, ultimately there has to be substance beneath it. A story can't survive on style alone, on wordplay, on puns. I do try my best to be as artful as possible with word choice and rhythm, but there's got to be something substantial there for a reader to reflect on, and that's my goal every time I write.
Seeing as how you have this kind of sort of, you know, kind of rumination process, I'm wondering how long it takes you to fashion and write a story, and how much of, it seems to me that a lot of these stories might, you know, be in some sort of gestation mode for a good period of time before you get a chance to write them. Is this kind of the case, or?
That's true. Many of the stories I may have written the first draft in a couple of weeks, but may have taken anywhere from several months to several years to actually draft out those stories to the published version that you see.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is easy to write yourself in a corner when you have big characters, odd characters, finding themselves in the bizarre situations, to take an easy way out, and it did for me require a lot of thought. Usually I think about a story, I would ruminate about a story for weeks. One occasion, about 4 years, with the first story.
Oh, really?
The Man Who Never Dies, I came up with the concept and wrote it down, and it was about 4 years later before I actually thought I knew enough about the characters and where the story would go to actually start writing it.
Mm-hmm.
I do like to plot a little bit out in advance. I like to do research, and when I feel like I know the character well enough that I can write his story, then I start. And I can't start before then.
Well, there's also something tricky, like, for example, in the story of the Aristotelian, you have an extremely hefty man as one of the characters. Now, what steps do you take to sort of make something like that, a character like that, believable, rather than, I mean, because that could have easily sort of dwindled into sort of a heavy-handed metaphor, but no, we know this guy. We have some sense of, you know, what his predicament is. This must have taken a while to kind of ruminate upon, I'm thinking.
I rewrote that story over a span of about 4 years as well, actually. Because you want your characters, the character should be dynamic, and a character just can't be obese. What else does he do besides eat? And it does take some time to come up with those other interests. What would they be? The fact that maybe he works as a telemarketer. Oh, he can do that from his bed, sure. Okay, what else? Well, maybe he's, because of his time bedridden, he likes to read, and so he's very intelligent. But what about what issues? What subjects fascinate him? Well, how about flowers and as well as food? Just make this guy embrace life, even though he's bedridden and can't really embrace life firsthand, he can through his imagination, through his intelligence, by reading. And so he knows, you know, it seems a vast array of subjects, from philosophy to the arts. And it is time consuming to come up with those other facets of that character, so that he's not just an obese man that people can laugh at, but people can be amazed by.
Yeah. So basically, it seems to me that there's just a good deal of work here just before you can actually really make this character alive, in the sense that, you know, you need to set indefinite sort of ground rules. I mean, do you feel that, you know, how many ground rules do you have to set for a particular character before you know, okay, this is it, and you feel confident enough to go ahead and portray this character in a reasonable or realistic sort of light?
Ground rules? I guess the primary one would be, does this guy surprise me and make me want to learn more about him? Mm-hmm. And if I'm surprised by the character, and if I'm excited about the situations this character could find himself in, that I could not only enjoy, but could also learn from. And I've got to enjoy the character in some way, whether he's despicable or not. If I can enjoy at least following him, but also learn something from. I'm always after that. What can I learn from this character, whether psychologically or emotionally? And what fun can I have with this character? And will he surprise me? And once I figure out what those things are, at least in a significant way, but maybe not fully, because I want to be surprised throughout the writing process, ultimately where the story goes, but I've got to have some sense of the surprise and the excitement. And that's where I'm going to get the adrenaline rush to actually begin writing the story.
Gotcha. Now, I was sort of really surprised to learn about the history of the Romanticist and the Classicist. And this kind of touches upon the original kind of question I asked you about, you know, how you were viewed for being a Southern writer. Maybe you can talk about this and why these kinds of auctorial impressions exist.
Well, with this story, I came very close to getting into the Atlantic Monthly. My professor at the University of Arkansas, where I received my MFA, suggested I submit this story, thought it would be perfect for the Atlantic Monthly, and the fiction editor didn't call me, but he called my professor and said, I really like this story, I want to take it, but I've got to know one thing first. I've got to know, is Sidney Thompson black or is he white? And my professor answered honestly, and the fiction editor just admitted he couldn't take the story because it would be too politically incorrect for a white author to be writing about black characters who do discuss race. Mm-hmm. but sometimes very directly using the N-word. So I feel ultimately I feel it's silly that we have to, as writers, worry that we should screen ourselves, that there are certain truths we can't expose, there are certain subjects we can't discuss intellectually, because we are supposed to be liberal, open-minded. And that's where my disgust for readers sometimes comes from, intellects come from. And that's why at times I feel like I need to mock them, mm-hmm. as I do in the Romanticist and the Classicist and other stories, that all the answers are not in books. And it just seems absurd that as a writer I should investigate certain things because of the color of my skin, not based on the experiences I've had living in Memphis, going to almost all black schools. It doesn't matter what my experiences are, it just matters what my skin color is, and that will dictate what I can write about.
Well, it also says a lot about the Atlantic Monthly, too.
Well, and I think it does, but I don't think it's only the Atlantic Monthly. And you know, I can't help it. I don't want to sound bitter talking. I can feel that way, but I'm really proud of the story, and it has gotten a lot of attention. It's just odd that it gets so much attention. It's kind of baffling. I mean, obviously, I wrote the story to incite people a little bit, to get people to think about racial issues and how they dictate the justice system at times, and what people can get away with in terms of committing murder or not. And we see this time and time again with urban violence. People get killed. We don't know who did it. Do we really care? Sometimes not. Mm-hmm. Or why does it happen so frequently? I have characters who get away with things that people in the news get away with that you see frequently. But I shouldn't discuss it in fiction. Let's just watch it in the news. That's okay. And so when I said earlier, it seems odd that sometimes people can accept certain truths only in a non-fictional medium, and really struggle with it in fiction, because maybe they don't know how to deal with it in the context. Maybe I'm not sure how I rub people the wrong way, but sometimes I do, and I'm trying to really wrap my mind around that. And ultimately, I think it might be this. I don't really go out of my way to help the reader know where I stand. I just want to present a character or a set of characters, a situation, and I try to show all sides of the subject as much as I can, and I ultimately want the reader to reach his or her own conclusion. And because I work so hard not to sound too sanctimonious or preachy of a certain theme or subject or thought, that maybe some readers just don't know what my angle is and therefore are troubled by the story. And I don't know. That's all I can guess.
Huh. I mean, it's interesting, too, because when you do have a short story that tackles such an unusual kind of set of characters that presents no easy answers, you have a situation where, like, people, you know, I see this a lot, you know, I see this not only with fiction, but I see this with, like, films and television, where people are trying to sort of assess the political agenda or the sort of ideological agenda of the author, you know. In such a climate, do you think that, you know, fiction has some, you know, this is a serious kind of issue for contemporary fiction, or?
Well, it may be the most serious.
Yeah.
Because if you can't be honest as a writer and express things that you feel need to be expressed, I'm not sure what our purpose is.
Yeah. Gotcha.
It's odd to me that a television show like The Sopranos, or a movie, so to say, like Pulp Fiction, can play with racial, maybe play is the wrong word, but certainly present racial conflict side by side with other issues, sometimes in a tongue-in-cheek fashion, and get away with it, and the audience will get it, will understand what's going on. And sometimes in the process of reading, the reader gets baffled by that. And I'm not sure why that is. I certainly hope readers haven't become less savvy, but I fear that's true.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting, too. I mean, you know, I know that you had a good deal of trouble trying to get this short story collection published. And if we're dealing with a situation where short story collections, even from, like, established authors, often end up being mid-list titles, and the short story climate that exists is unwilling to sort of, you know, portray these truths, how is the short story seriously in trouble here, or what do we do to, you know, really ensure that we, you know, have this kind of heft, have this kind of ambiguity that causes people to sort of reconsider their notions of the world?
I don't know if I have an answer. I wish I did. I don't think it's just, you know, just one writer, myself, you know, crying in a soup about having certain difficulties. I see it all over the place with other writers. I'm not sure. The short story, certainly, it's an important genre of writing. I mean, you can get so much in such a short period of time, and it's such a wonderfully concise piece of writing, and I'm not sure why it's being pushed away, because most major publishers won't touch a collection the way they used to. If you had a story published in the Atlantic Monthly, it made a career, and that was one reason why it was so upsetting for me to get so close and then be turned away for a bogus reason. But nowadays, it doesn't mean so much. You're not guaranteed a published collection because you get in the New Yorker or the Atlantic Monthly, and so I do think there is trouble ahead for the short story. Nobody really, even a small press or mid-list press, wants to publish a collection. It seems necessary in terms of maybe just being a goodwill gesture to
sure.
the world, and not a lot is expected of you, and that's kind of nice in its own way, not to have great expectations or pressures that you will sell 20,000 copies. Mm-hmm. But it is disappointing that you know you won't.
What about, you know, I noticed that that Sideshow got a lot of coverage around, you know, in a lot of Southern newspapers. I mean, certainly, like, the Lit Blog Co-op selecting this kind of, you know, bridges the divide, but this kind of parochialism, this kind of notion of regionalism when reading that, you know, what do you think of this, and what do you think could be done to possibly sort of, you know, get like some, you know, blue stater like me to, you know, I mean, I read everything as much as I can, but at the same time, you know, it's like, I would love to see more Southern fiction covered in the New York Times or the Chicago Sun-Times or whatnot, you know?
Well, I have to admit, for whatever reason, the South as a region does embrace its writers better than any other region embraces its own writers. And I don't know if that's a little bit of the dark horse. It goes back to the Civil War and people feeling like they need to band together and help each other. We're all one big family. But it's true that I certainly got attention from Southern newspapers, not one that was not Southern. I don't know if the Southern papers felt indebted, like that there's some sense of civil charity to help a, original author, but they do go a little more out of their way to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly nice to know that you're going to have that network as a Southern author. I mean, I don't take that for granted. I don't take it lightly. It is marvelous, and I do sympathize with those writers, especially short story writers, who live in other regions who really can't depend on their region to support them in the media. And I feel grateful that the LBC has nominated my book and that I've gone outside the region. I certainly don't want to just be a Southern writer. I don't think of myself that way. So I'm glad that others don't view me simply that way.
Sure. All right. Well, thanks so much, Sydney. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks. Cool. Hang on 1 second.
The children are slum on my side of the city. They all act so tough. They're looking so pretty. They hide in the dark because bright lights are so deadly. The radio screams. Their friends are